accession number 17576, reel 1.
This is an interview with Nigel Walpole, recorded by Rodney Giesler on the 10th of July 1997 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Nigel, can you tell me when you were born and a bit about your family background?
Yes, my mother's father was a Danish, came over from Denmark, well, Bornholm to be precise, in the last century, and set up a market garden in the Lee Valley. I was born in Sawbridgeworth in Hertfordshire in February 1934, who lived in the same area, and I grew up in Cheshunt in Hertfordshire.
And what sort of stage did you decide you wanted to join the RAF?
My childhood, of course, coincided with the beginning of the war, and I suppose I was inspired by seeing the air battles over London. Indeed, we were very close to North Weald Airfield, and that must have been some sort of inspiration. It must have begun there.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually go to the airfield and watch the aircraft taking off, or weren't you allowed to?
No, I think I was too young to do that on my own, and I certainly wasn't able to get there in any other way.
So you went through your education aiming at a career in the RAF eventually, did you?
I can't remember any other ambition.
Mm-hmm. And then you got direct entry into Cranwell, was it? Or?
No, in 1951 I joined as a short service officer to become a navigator. And I started my training for that role down at Thorney Island on Valletta's, Anson's and Wellington's, but before I could get to the latter, I was selected to go to the Royal Air Force College.
Uh-huh. And going to the Royal Air Force College meant you were automatically trained as a pilot, were you? Or?
I thought that I was going there as one of the first navigators, but they didn't join until much later, and indeed I became a pilot, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what you flew, did they have Jeff Provost in those days, or it was before that time?
It was before that time. We started on Chipmunks. I then went on to the splendid Harvard, and then on to the Balliol for my last two terms.
Mm-hmm. And your first operational squadron was what?
Was number 26, Day Fighter Squadron at Oldenburg in North Germany.
Mm-hmm. Flying what?
These were the Hunter 4s,
mm-hmm.
With the rather sensitive Avon engines, and our first experience, of course, of firing a 30mm Aden cannon.
Mm-hmm. And they'd cured the problem of the cannon's smoke putting out the engines by that time.
By that time, we weren't able to fire the guns on the Mark 1 Hunters that we converted to at Chivna, but by the time we got to Oldenburg, they'd fitted the Sabrinas to carry the empty Lynx. And the engine was not affected anymore because we had fuel dipping incorporated.
Mm. And was that a ground attack version Hunter? Or?
No, we were all, and I think there might have been 10 to 12 Hunter day fighter squadrons in North Germany at that time. None of them were in the ground attack role at this stage.
Mm. And what that was purely cannon armament, or did you carry out a missile?
No, cannon only.
Yeah. And the form of interception was what? By eyeball, was it? Not one eyeball?
No, we had radar control. I suspect that it might not have been as efficient as we would have liked, and so a lot of it might have come down to visual acquisition in the end. And in those days, it was all medium to high level,
mm-hmm.
between 30 and 50,000 feet.
Yeah. The threat from the Warsaw Pact, therefore, was both strategic and tactical bombers, were there, that you had to insert?
Yes, indeed, and many of them would have been perhaps passing through, or more likely to the north of us on the way to the United Kingdom, but both threats were a part of the scenario.
Mm. And you practiced the scenario over and over again on air exercise?
Continuously. It was really a very routine exercise in the middle to upper airspace.
And how much of your time was spent on Hunters?
I did 2 years on number 26 Squadron before Duncan Sands took a hand in things. So many of our squadrons were lost at that time. Instead of coming back to the United Kingdom, I was posted on to number 79 Swift FR5 squadron down at Gutterslow.
Now, this was a totally different type of flying for fighter reconnaissance.
This was entirely different. It was all at low level, all at very high speeds, and indeed the Swift was ideal for that purpose and would not have liked the upper airspace from whence I had come.
It was a fairly smooth aircraft at low altitude, was it?
The Swift was very stable. It had wonderful ailerons. You could fly almost hands-off, even in turbulence, at very low level in order to write the hieroglyphics on your knee pad from your reconnaissance targets. It was better in that sense than the Hunter which I was to fly in the same role later.
Now, can you tell me a bit about the cameras fitted to the Swift? How many cameras did it carry?
It carried three cameras. There were ideas of an alternative fit, but we ended up, and they remained the same throughout its life, as F95 70mm oblique cameras, one in the forward-facing station in the nose and one either side of the nose, with cycle rates of 4 and 8 frames a second, which enabled us to take excellent photography with the required overlap at the very high speeds and low level that we were operating. And I think in that sense, we were unique at that time in that capability.
Now, to get clear pictures flying at that speed where the scenery is rushing by in a very blurred way, how do you actually get a clear still in those circumstances?
This was a strip aperture camera. I think I had not come across such a system before, but it was absolutely ideal for its purpose and outclassed any other that was available at that time for the other air forces.
When you say strip aperture, is it a bit like a focal plane shutter in that you've got a strip of daylight that moves down the film?
I believe that's the way it operated. I'm afraid I can't recall much more.
In step with the object as it goes by, presumably.
I'm afraid I'm getting out of my depth here, but I believe you may be right,
yes. But you mentioned the camera type anyway, so presumably there is access to the technical camera.
Yes, indeed, and I have a documentary evidence of that here, if you want it.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. Now, how exactly do you do this? Do you fly along with one wing low, so you're pointing at that part of the ground you want? How do you actually fly that sort of thing?
It depends entirely on the target, how close you are to it, and you may make a mistake in your run-in, how high you are, and what speed you are. You may be able to take the target, which incidentally should be positioned in the lower one-third of the 9x9 format, which is the final product of this exercise. You may be able to do it wings level. You may have to dip a wing. And indeed, you can fly vertically over a target and take a vertical with an oblique camera by doing that, rolling over it, as it were. But it is something which you get used to. We had very little guidance or marks on canopies or aiming devices. It was a matter of gaining experience.
Really? You didn't have
nothing
any form of sighting equipment?
No. The Americans did. They had a very comprehensive scope in which you could aim your photography. We had nothing, and yet it didn't hold us back at all, as far as I recall. We just learned it very quickly, and we might not get it absolutely precise, but it was certainly good enough for the purpose.
You didn't have any cameras going out of the belly of the aircraft?
There were no vertical cameras, although I have looked at the specification for the FR5, and as I suggested earlier, that was an original idea, that there would be vertical cameras. They were never incorporated.
Now, the sort of targets that you would be flying tactical exercises on would be presumably troop concentrations, tank concentrations, trying to get through camouflaging. What were you sent to look for?
Yes, ideally, you're right. I would have committed the Swift with its relatively limited range into the forward edge of the battle area, the Feba, and around the Flot, to help the army find out what was directly ahead of them. This was its best purpose in my view, and therefore we will be looking to see which routes were being used by the enemy advancing upon us, and that was the scenario we expected, not, I fear, going the other way, whether we had struck the bridges that were crucial to the campaign, whether there were helicopter deployment areas forward, and indeed where the troop concentrations were, as you suggest. Those were the ideal targets for the tactical reconnaissance in which we were involved.
Now, even presumably you were told to take pictures of certain map coordinates and this sort of thing. Now, you would do it whether you could see the target visually or not. I mean, you know, the camouflage techniques and things like that that emerge in.
Yes, indeed. There were occasions when we were asked to do reconnaissance over a particular pinpoint, and when we got there we found nothing. But we would certainly take photographs of that position, and we would radio back our findings, and the words would be, nothing seen at location given. You've harped on the photography side, but I would like to stress the importance of the in-flight report. Because this, of course, provides instant intelligence to a terminal on the ground, providing that terminal was in place, and it would enable the army to know instantly what was going on at that moment directly ahead of them. And I valued the in-flight report from a visual sighting well above the photography that everyone thinks that reconnaissance was about.
Mm. Nevertheless, doing a visual reconnaissance is a pretty demanding role. I mean, you're moving at a tremendous airspeed. The scenery is flashing by at great speed. It's probably inadvisable to do more than one run over a target because they may be waiting for you with missiles on the second run. So you've got to have eyes that are going to pick up salient points so you can report back. Again, is this visual training that you've...
Yes, absolutely, and you've already highlighted some salient points there. First and foremost, you would not go round again. You would be asking for trouble. It is likely to be fatal. They'll be waiting for you. I agree with that. So it has to be achieved, this reconnaissance, in one pass, both photography and the visual sightings. But you can pick up, and the speeds we were travelling would certainly be in the order of 480 knots, perhaps 560 in hostile areas, only if we were short of fuel because of the distance to the target would we come down to 420. But I can assure you that at those speeds we can pick up the crucial elements of the target array by the naked eye, to be confirmed later and to give detail from the photographs. For instance, we would, as I suggested, be able to tell whether the bridge was there or not, whether the route was being used, whether there was or was not a concentration. Let's stick to those three key target elements. You can certainly do that with visual reconnaissance, and you can report it back instantly, providing you have the facility, the communications that are not jammed, and the terminal on the ground ready to take that information and pass it to the soldiers who need it there and then.
Now, in the case of a photographic mission, how quickly can you turn around? Is it just a matter of taking the cameras out and putting new ones in?
Yes, indeed. And I don't deny that the photographs can be very useful, but you are talking about a great delay in getting back to your base to start with, and the possibility of not being able to get back to the base that has the processing facilities. Of course, your own will have, and others within the NATO network might have. But assuming you can get to those facilities, you would only be on the ground for about 10 minutes before wet negatives are available for interrogation.
Quickly as that.
As quickly as that, and then prints would be available within, say, 15 minutes. So that's not a problem, but the problem is getting back to a facility. It could be 20 minutes, 30 minutes, during which time the army could be on the move, and if you haven't got your report through from your visual sighting, your photographs might not be of any use and might do little more than merely confirm what you have already said.
Can you recall any particular sorties that you flew where you may have had difficulty spotting it, or you spotted something against all the odds, or any interesting memories in that of that line?
It's very difficult after 40 or 50 years to remember specific. It happened every day. What you're suggesting happened every day. We would get to a position given by our taskers and find nothing there, but it is possible that the photographs would have revealed something. It might they may have penetrated the camouflage. We didn't see it. Now, if that is so, it could be significant, or it could be almost immaterial to the land-air battle. A small platoon of soldiers dug into the edge of a wood may not be very significant in the big scheme of things. However, if we detected by photograph and not by eye an armoured division in there through photographs, then obviously it was. Likewise, we could easily pick up, and almost always did, additional information on which we were not tasked, which could be invaluable, and that too would be passed back in the in-flight report immediately, and photographs would be taken even though we had not been tasked at that position.
Mm-hmm. Now, your exercises presumably were against, in quotes, troops who were simulating the enemy. I mean, they would presumably exercise for your benefit in ways and techniques that the Warsaw Pact forces would actually operate if they come crossing over the border.
I think that's what we would have liked them to do, but I suspect they did not do that. I suspect they carried out their own tactics, and we were an add-on to their exercises, generally speaking. It was rare that anyone exercised specifically for our purpose, but in that event, I would hope that they would try and copy Warsaw Pact tactics and techniques, though I would not have much confidence in that.
Yeah. What was the doomsday scenario? I mean, if there had been an outbreak of war, the Warsaw Pact armoured divisions presumably would have come across the North German plains, Lüneburg Heath and around there. Is that what you were briefed that you would have to meet?
Indeed, and as I implied earlier on, there was never any suggestion that we would be going east, and indeed, when certain aggressive commanders even suggested that that might be the best way of defence, they were shouted down immediately by the politicians. So the scenarios always envisaged massive conventional land force penetration by the many different but well-known and well-named units within the Warsaw Pact, and how they would do it depended upon the terrain, and you've already hinted that. From north to south, of course, the terrain was very, very different from the flatlands of the Lüneburger Heide, north of Hanover, through into the hills of the Harz Mountains, and then down to the natural barriers and natural entry points further south. So it really... Now, we obviously... that is, army and air staffs attempted to guess where they would penetrate, and we would try and concentrate our attention on those areas. And as a result, there was much pre-planning that could be carried out, and pre-planned missions were already laid onto maps for that purpose. But we were equally well prepared to take on the unexpected, should an Ardennes situation recur in the Third World War.
Mm-hmm. Did you attend any courses run by the army on the structure of the Warsaw Pact and how they operated in the field? Was it deemed to be useful for you?
This was a continuing ground training program of great diversity. I can't say that there were any set agendas or major training courses. It was an ongoing educational purpose, and we carried out our own training and with the army as well. But no specific courses for the likes of us on the flight line in my time.
Now, a typical sortie then would be quick takeoff, low level to the target, low level back. You didn't climb at all.
Well, now, this was a bone of contention. One of my great concerns throughout my career, and we're jumping ahead, was the battle management, as I call it, that is the targeting, the tasking, and the management of our assets, and whether we would be tasked within our capabilities. And now I come back to your point. Our two Swift squadrons in the mid-50s were stationed at Jever, well up in East Friesland, up in North Germany, near Wilhelmshaven, and down in the central plain at Gütersloh. If you were at Jever, you might well have to do a high-low profile into your targets if you were tasked down into the middle or south of our area. And they would not be too unhappy to do that, providing there was something like 100 miles to go before they entered into hostile airspace. At Gütersloh, we were much closer to the inner German border, and we would never climb. We would go low all the way. It wouldn't be worth climbing.
And this is purely fuel conservation?
This is fuel conservation because, as everyone wants to point out, and it isn't necessarily material if we are properly tasked, we didn't have a great deal of fuel. We were probably talking about a standard training trip of 1 hour at 420 knots, and 1 hour 10, 1 hour 15 at 360 knots. But that's a training sortie. And if we wanted to use our 480 knot, 540 knot dash in hostile airspace, we couldn't do anywhere near those times. Now, you can work it out that from Gütersloh, we can easily cover the sort of tactical area that I explained in the forward edge of the battle area, the FIBA, and outsay to the crucial Elbe-Saale feature line, on which there are key bridges. Now, we're likely to fight this side of that river, and the Swift could easily reach it. And we could use those dash speeds that I referred to.
With afterburner?
Well, you would use the afterburner to accelerate, yeah. And then you would come out of afterburner once you'd reached those speeds. I mean, you could reach 600 knots with afterburner, but, of course, you're really getting rid of the fuel, and you need to get back, and you need to have a contingency plan, too, in case Gütersloh had been bombed, in our case, and we had to go somewhere else, with or without the photo facilities to take advantage of that sortie. So we had to think about these things too. High lows could have been done from Jever. They wouldn't have liked it. They'd have preferred to go low, low all the time. And I have to remind you that the prevailing weather in Germany is such that if you do a high low, and there was no question of being able to give a radar letdown of any sort in a wartime environment, even if it was available, you might have great difficulty getting down to low level where you needed to be for your targets if you'd done a high-low. So high-lows are very unlikely tactics and certainly not looked forward to by anyone anywhere in North Germany at that time.
Talking about the weather, presumably all your flying was done under visual flight rules.
I don't know that we ever referred to visual flight rules in those days. We had limits. They were published. I don't recall what they were. I'm not even sure that we really kept to them. We were very, very good at wheedling our way around at ultra-low level in the generally appalling low cloud bases and visibilities of North Germany. We might have to reduce the speeds at certain times. We might have to detour around and find gaps in the Harz Mountains if we'd gone to war in those weathers. But we learned to live and fly with those very difficult weather conditions. And we were better at it, I fear, to say, than perhaps some of our allies who were more strictly regulated in this way.
And you presumably you got to know the details of the landscape intimately.
Absolutely. I mean, there are those who boast that they don't need a map in North Germany because they've done so much flying over it. I think I've said the same myself. But, of course, when you get into the target area, you must have maps for your precise locations.
Did you do any night reconnaissance work with flashes?
No.
Because they did have these huge flashes they used to let off, didn't they?
Both the Canberras and the B-66s did have that capability. Mm. It all sounds very hazardous to me to drop the flares to take your photographs. They certainly did it. I think it's a rather unhealthy occupation.
Were you equipped in those days for electronic intelligence at all?
We had absolutely nothing in the tactical roles. There may have been other aeroplanes of other squadrons operating from the United Kingdom which did, but I know nothing of them.
Now, you, around about that time, went on an exchange posting with the American Air Force, did you?
Yes, I did. At the end of 1959, I went to Shore Air Force Base in South Carolina, onto the RF-101 Voodoo, in the reconnaissance role, to carry out the same sort of job that I'd just come from on the Swift.
How different was the Voodoo to the Swift?
Very different indeed. The Voodoo, I think, was conceived as a strategic fighter. I'm not sure whether that's the right word. And for that role, it may have been very good, although, of course, it wasn't committed to it, as far as I know. It was a very big aeroplane. It was very powerful, very fast. It had two Pratt & Whitney, I think, J-57 engines, which would give it 30,000 pounds of thrust with both in reheat, and it could achieve 1.57 Mach. Of course, you didn't need those speeds down low, although it's useful to have the very high speed, if only for evasion. And evasion was the name of the word for the Voodoo, because unlike the Swift, it didn't have any defensive armament. In the Swift, we had 2 30mm cannon. We trained with them. We were very good at air-to-air at low levels, where we would have been fighting. And incidentally, they were used for air-to-ground as well, which is a bonus. The Voodoo had no guns. It was jokingly said that this was a policy decision, lest fighter reconnaissance pilots decided to pick a fight or look for a fight and forget that their primary role was tactical reconnaissance. I don't know whether I believe that, but in any event, we didn't have any guns, so the only way out was to run for it. And it had all this power to do just that.
Where did you train in America?
I trained on the same base. The base accommodated the Voodoo Training School, 4414th Combat Crew Training Squadron, and it supplied a very large Voodoo force in Central Europe and Southeast Asia, and it had two resident operational squadrons on that base as well, one of which I belonged to for a time before returning to the training unit to become an instructor pilot.
But you didn't actually fly with Voodoos in overseas theatres of operation?
No, I didn't. Although we were ready to go at any time, and indeed on New Year's Eve of 1960, we were pulled out of the New Year's Eve party to take an early bed, check our aeroplanes, and prepare to go to Laos the following morning. In the event, we didn't go because the reception facilities in Laos were not available. And I don't think I would have been allowed to go had the embassy in Washington known about it.
Mm-hmm. How different was it flying in an American squadron? Were they different personalities, different techniques, different procedures?
Yes, I want to be a little careful here. I have a tremendous, and had a tremendous, admiration and respect for the American Air Force, but perhaps in different ways. They were a very large, well-equipped air force, but they were driven very largely by procedures. Procedures in terms of weather, in terms of low flying, in terms of navigation from A to B. They would fly airways, or we would fly hopefully direct under radar cover. They had the facilities to do that. They covered very, very much greater ranges. They would be prepared to as I've already suggested, deploy worldwide at a moment's notice with huge backup facilities in air-to-air refueling and transport to bring logistics command. In those days, the Royal Air Force squadrons that we were involved with in Germany had no such commitments and therefore no such experience. Things have changed now, of course.